Radio Spirale. Jørgen Leth est une des figures les plus fascinantes de la culture danoise contemporaine. Poète et documentariste, il est cité par Lars von Trier comme une de ses grandes influences, il est également commentateur cycliste vedette pour la télévision et habite depuis quelques années en Haïti. Le Port de Tête le recevait en novembre 2011 à l'occasion de la parution de Trivial Everyday Things, un recueil de poèmes. L'entretien qui suit se déroule en anglais.
Thank you for coming. A marvelous turnout. This is really encouraging. Fantastic. Jay's just given me a new angle on the way we got this published, actually, because, or maybe I'll give him a new angle, because I actually contacted Karen Fastrup and said, why don't you get in touch with Jay Miller and tell him about Jørn's poetry? So she did that, and I did that as well, and sent Jay a few samples. And he wrote back almost immediately and said, I'm totally interested. So thank you very much indeed. And we've now just, the both of us, we've just been given the finished product in our hands. We haven't seen it until now, so it's probably going to have to be surgically removed from my hand.
It's a great feeling.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very nice book indeed. So thank you very much for that. Yeah, Montreal, thanks. Very nice to be in Montreal. I didn't realize you had a tropical climate and until I went down into the subway and took the subway train up here this evening. It's, I think, it reminds me a bit of, well, or what I imagine Port-au-Prince must be like. All you need is a bit of monsoon rain down there.
Not
I think,
entirely.
Not entirely. Well, you haven't been in the subway yet.
Well.
No. Bit of monsoon rain and you'll have palm trees sprouting all over the place. But yeah, we've been having a fantastic time here in Montreal. We're here to present this book, which is amazingly the first selection of Jørn's poetry in English. How many books of poetry have you put out in Danish?
Ten. Yeah. Last one came just a month ago.
Yeah.
And I'm still writing poetry.
Yeah.
I wrote a lot of poems after the earthquake in Haiti. And that's part of the new collection of poetry that just came out. A lot of it is, I see as necessary ways to deal with the traumaticism of the earthquake experience. Well, I lost my house and I escaped in the last minute, etc. And you know, it was really a strong experience. And I needed to find language again. I needed to start from zero again. That's the feeling, and that's the drive for the new collection of poetry. Like finding language, finding ways to deal with things, and to deal and also to rediscover basic language. That's what I'm doing in the new collection, I think.
Yeah, we'll get back to the subject of Haiti a bit later. I should just mention, perhaps as well, that Jørn's collected poems came out in Danish about it's almost 10 years ago now,
yeah,
isn't it? So
yeah.
we're missing a couple of volumes, but it's a fairly weighty volume, as you can see. And
they're doing a new now, including the two new. They have to, because they have to update the selected the collected poems.
Okay, great. This one came out later, and as Jørn says, another one just came out about 3 weeks ago to great acclaim in Denmark. But this evening we're here to talk about trivial everyday things. And I mean, the main reason that you're here, Jørn, in Montreal is because of your participation at the RIDM documentary film festival, which has been going on here and will be continuing at least for another week or so. And you've been there having screenings of your films, you've done a masterclass. Happily, the whole thing coincided with the publication of this selection, so
yeah,
we could be
strangely
here.
Enough.
Yeah, so we're here, both of us, to present the book happily. Jørn Leth, poet, filmmaker, journalist, cycling commentator. And I think it would be no exaggeration to call you a giant of modern Danish culture in many respects. So I'm very honoured to be sitting here.
You're exaggerating. You're
but in every respect, you're a household name in Denmark.
They call me a Renaissance figure because I'm so spread over different genres and different interests. I can accept that.
Have you been having a good time in Montreal?
Yes, it has been wonderful. This retrospective has been... first of all, when I had several respects in my age, you know, they look back at my work, and that's very nice. I like that very much. And I mostly like to leave to the organizers of a festival to make the choices of film, to make a selection. It's more exciting for me with surprises, and I like to compare the different selections. And I'm very happy with the selection done here. And, you know, I have been extremely happy to discuss my work with a really intelligent and informed audience here in Montreal. I know they have a big tradition for documentary films in Montreal, in Canada, and I liked really to discuss my work with them. It has been fun and opened new angles and sometimes so very interesting questions that, you know, you have to surpass yourself to explain your work. That's great.
And you've been doing pretty much all of it in French as well.
Yeah, mostly in French. Mostly in French. That has been my obligation, I think.
Yeah.
But my French is a little more rusty than my English. But I do live in Haiti, so I also have to speak French there. Yeah. And I like to speak French as much as I can. But I felt sometimes during this long master classes and discussions with the audience that I sometimes got a little bit tired and wanted to shift to English. So I mixed it sometimes. Yeah. But not much, right?
Not much at all. I was very impressed indeed. I actually discovered that I could understand French by listening to Jörn.
Okay, that's good.
Because he speaks rather more slowly than the French speakers. As soon as anybody else took the stage, I was lost. But I could follow Jörn. But these two domains, film and poetry, are very much knotted together in your work, tightly intertwined. And I think anyone who's seen your most recent film, Erotic Man, which screened last night at the festival, was very well received indeed. I think anybody who's seen that film will realize the extent of the intertextuality that's going on in your work and has been going on in your work for some 40 years or so.
Yeah.
It's very explicit in that film, and you've got female actresses actually reciting your poems film, and you do so yourself as well, both as a voiceover and more explicitly being filmed reading your poetry. I'd like to come back to those poems that are included in that film a little bit later, but if we sort of rewind slightly and go a little further back in your film work to your work with Lars von Trier in The Five Obstructions. I saw that again recently at the festival here, and there are two or three poems included in that film which are also happily included in this selection. So I thought that perhaps we could hear you reading a couple of those poems as examples, and then tell us a little bit more about the relationship between film and poetry in your work. The first
and
of these
Lars von Trier.
Poems, and Lars von Trier. Very yes, definitely. We'd like to hear about Lars von Trier. Where did he get that tattoo?
That was a surprise to me.
Yeah. the first poem I'd like you to read is on page 117 in this magnificent new collection, and it's called Beginning, and it's actually the last poem in the selection. Some of you already have the
makes
book.
Makes sense. Should I read it?
Yeah.
Beginning. It could begin here, in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. I would like to know more about him. I can see that he is here, that he is working. I've seen him smoke a cigarette. I've not seen him write. Is he good at describing death? Is he thinking about fucking? Does he like to be alone? okay, this is where it begins. He has arrived. We can be certain of that. He is in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. That is the picture at this point in time.
The second poem I'd like you to read now is on page 98. It's the poem called The World Is Here. Verden ligger, in Danish, which is also included in Erotic Man.
Yes. The world is just here, beyond the wall, and I'm trying to pin down the perfect human in the space in which he moves. Is he free? Does he want something in particular? Where does he walk around? What is he doing? How exactly is he present? All these questions begin to insist. He is becoming flesh and blood. He's a human being, endeavoring to take shape, trying to grasp things and to move his own body in sensible patterns, inside and out. He's here. He says some words. He's inquisitive. He's experienced something he's trying to understand. He moves his hand and his foot. He takes off his jacket and puts it on. That is the first lesson, always, along with smoking a cigarette. The perfect human, this is just something we say, hoping he can do what we say he can. Just walk a little, say a few words, occupy the space together with a woman. This is what we want. It's not too much, but it's enough.
Lovely. I realize the first of these poems, Beginning, is not only features not only in Erotic Man, it's also in another of your films called Interference.
It's really condensed the content of this film. It's a feature film. It's the first film I ever made in Haiti in '82. During Jean-Claude Duvalier, I was there. I was against my producer's advice. I insisted on shooting this film, a feature film about a foreign correspondent. I insisted on shooting it in the crazy Haiti at that time, taking all the risks of being disturbed by the authorities or whatever. But I shot it there, and that poem I read there, Beginning, is really a way to put the main character in place in the film. So it's a small synopsis. And this is actually an example of how that you call intertextuality with a good word is also an inspiration sometimes for my filmmaking. I always say that my films should learn or do learn from my poetry, in the sense that very often poetry is the most free form you can have. I mean, you always start in the upper left corner and you don't know where it leads you. You start writing the poem. I never know where. I know I don't have a program, and certainly I don't have an ideological program at all. I just want to examine where the language will lead me. And very often these sketches constitute small synopses, small ideas that I can later use. And also the courage in doing things that way appeals to me as a filmmaker. I want to be as free, as spontaneous in films that I can be in texts. That's of course a high, order, because in films, you're dependent on a lot of technical things, crew, work out of certain shots. But still, I keep that in mind, the freeness of writing poetry as an inspiration for the way of a certain way of making films.
In the second of those films, you've got the perfect man walking around again, the perfect man from your celebrated film from 1967. Yeah, which. Features very strongly, of course, in The Five Obstructions as well.
I have him walking around there. I think this poem, the second one I read, is also in the animation part of The Five Obstructions.
Yeah.
if I'm not mistaken. I think so. It's there.
But the fact that you have this intertextuality going on means that in many respects the works are almost interchangeable. the films and the poems.
I always, sorry, I interrupt you here, but I also very consciously, there's some gaps between the books of poetry that I publish. That could be 8 years, that could be 13 years, that could be 5 years. But when I made the Five Obstructions, I felt I had to update my poetry. I had to, because I had this intersectionality dependence between them, but I needed to update the poetry. I needed to write new poems to also to show for myself that I'm working on two parallel tracks, poetry and films. They're very connected, and I cannot leave one of these tracks abandoned. I can't. And that was very good choice, because then after that I produced, I think, some of my best poetry, Billedet Forestiller, The Picture Shows, and also this one, and now the new one. So they came after this conscious decision about coming back to poetry.
It sounds like you can almost write poetry on demand, when you put it that way.
Is that
true?
No, that's not true. No, you know, the most recent experience I have is I left Haiti in a helicopter, evacuated after the earthquake, and tried to settle in the Dominican Republic. But that was a really bad solution. I mean, I didn't feel at ease there. I was longing for coming back to my friends in Haiti, and I think the difference is so striking between those two countries. And then I decided to come back to Haiti 1st of February. I took the bus 1st of February from Santo Domingo to Cap-Haïtien in the north. I couldn't go back to my house because it was destroyed totally. I went back to a hotel on the north coast, and that's where I'm still living. And then when I arrived the 1st of February, I started immediately writing poetry. And I had to be very disciplined with myself. So I was walking every day, a tough walk on a mountain path. And that kept up my moral for writing poetry. It's strange, but that's how it is. That's how it is to convince yourself that you can still be alive or produce something. That was what it was all about, I think.
Was that a conscious decision to try to come to terms with what happened in Haiti? Was it a conscious decision to write your way out of it, or was it just something that happened on its own? The poems began.
It happened on it, both. I can say yes and yes, because I really felt that I had to relieve myself of certain images and a certain desperate experience. I knew that there was a salvation in writing poetry. I knew that. It's after all a therapeutic function of producing literature about whatever. But in any case of life, I think poetry is also playing a role as a therapy. And in this case, I felt very inspired by the thing that I had to reinvent language, as I said before. I had to find language from the bottom of, from zero. And that was a very strong motivation to continue that writing process.
And that notion of intertextuality doesn't just work crosswise between the genres of film and poetry. It also occurs within the poetry itself, because the new poems that you mentioned, where you're trying to come to terms with what happened in Haiti, a lot of them refer back to a lot of previous poems as well. Yeah.
Well, I have been talking about that when in the retrospective also a lot, that I'm very faithful to old inspirations. I'm very faithful to my original inspirations in filmmaking. I'm faithful to certain painters that I like very much. I mean, visual artists like Andy Warhol, Magritte, Marcel Duchamp. I'm coming back to the inspirations. There's a certain faithfulness in this work. And also in the poetry, absolutely. I do come back to, and I do like to recycle, in a way, motifs. Mm-hmm. I'm not shy of recycling motifs, as you know, at all.
Well, it's a lot easier that way, isn't it?
Easier.
Well, something that's very evident from the couple of poems we heard you read just there, and in a very, very large number of your poems, is this sort of observational approach to everything. It occurs in your films, it occurs in your poetry, where the poet, I mean, there's a kind of camera-like quality about the poems, where the poet, the camera, dwells on objects,
yes.
States of affairs, whatever. And you've talked as well about l'espace vide. Is that how you say it in French? The empty space?
Yeah, the empty space. Yeah, yeah, l'espace vide, I think.
Yeah, okay. This empty space into which objects and states of affairs and people can be placed and observed almost as if under a microscope.
That
runs through your films and through your poetry as well.
From the poetry also, yes. I'm observing. I have no business with messages, political messages or opinions at all, neither in my films nor in my poems. I'm an observer. And I'm an experimenter. I experiment with language. I want to reinvent language in film and in poetry. I want to simplify. Always the tendency is more and more to simplify and to use humble language. I mean, humble words and simple short sentences. More and more. I'm more and more cutting down. And that has, I like to refer to a French poet that I like very much, Jules Supervier, who once wrote that he wanted to invite all the small gray words of the language into a big feast, a big party. I like that very much, and I connect to that. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying cook it in, to cut down,
condense,
and I'm going, but it's there from the beginning.
Yeah.
When I go back to my early poems, I see it's there already. I'm trying to write short sentences, condensed sentences, no opinions, a lot of observations, a lot of surface, a lot of studying of surface. I like to study surface. I like to see what is there. And when I start writing a new book of poems, I sometimes decide what is the area that I want to describe. So I put myself in strange summer houses in the wintertime where there's no view at all, but I that's like punishing myself. That's like creating monk-like circumstances. So there the task is to describe the closest things. That's the things which are on the table, for instance. The things you can see out of the window, foggy and what you can see on television. I always insisted when I rented these houses, strange houses, during. I asked my wife if she agreed I could go there a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. Then I always insisted there must be a television, because I need to see the outer world, what's happening on television while I'm writing, or between writing. So that's a kind of discipline. I always work with rules of game, as you've seen in my films also.
Yeah. But while you may insist on being able to watch television in these places you go to write poetry, it doesn't seep in the way of your poems ever dealing with sort of current affairs, politics, the things that you might watch on the television news.
Not
you,
really.
You've never had any ambitions of being a political writer.
Oh, absolutely not. And I don't, not, and in, still worse, political films, I don't. I don't like films which are insisting on teaching the audience something. I don't like that. That includes Michael Moore.
Yeah. You mentioned these little grey words.
Yeah.
the idea of your language in the poetry being very unembellished and unostentatious and very plain. That's actually one of the most interesting things from a translation perspective. Yes. On the surface of things, it might look very easy. It might look like an easy task to translate the poetry of Jørn Leth because it's very simple. But if you sort of compare the two languages, Danish and English, I think you'll find, if you go to a library and pick up a dictionary of the Danish language and a dictionary of the English language, I think the chances are that the English dictionary is going to be a lot fatter than the yes. Danish dictionary. English is a much wordier language yeah. than Danish. Yeah. And that presents a problem because I found that, I mean, some poems didn't make it into the selection. That was because I thought that the translation didn't work in a way because it seemed to me just too plain, too flat in English, whereas yeah. the Danish poem seemed to work extremely well indeed. So that was actually a very difficult thing to come to terms with.
I think that's because, a consequence of what you are describing is that the Danish language has fewer words, but they cover a bigger area, right? That gives a lot of poetic possibilities.
Exactly, yeah. yeah. Whereas in English, you'll have to choose between five or six. The idea of describing objects and placing things into an empty space and observing them, it makes for a lot of distance in your poetry. And I think one of the things I find most striking about your poetry is that the poems evoke a great sense of loneliness very often. The poet is a very detached observer in your Leth's poetry. And there's a sort of sense of loneliness very often, which I find very appealing and very attractive.
Okay, I can't comment on that.
It becomes meditative in a way.
Yeah. Pardon?
It becomes meditative in a way. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I was thinking... I'd ask you to read a couple of poems, actually, which might be illustrative of that, hopefully. The first one being New Tires on page 83.
Yes.
If you can find that.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah? You don't recognize it?
Yeah, I do recognize it. I do recognize it. New Tires. The white man fucks the black woman amid voodoo and death. That's how simple I see it. Let me go on. The palm tree trembles. The sea prostitutes itself every day. Animals murmur in the inner sanctum. The gate is closed all day, and there's no water in the pool. I buy 4 new tires and arrange a repair of the chassis. Oh, that's all.
The second poem is Pas de Deux, Three, as it is in this selection. That's on page 76.
Yeah. Yes. Pas de Deux, Three. Rain drumming on tin roofs. An ocean inclining upwards, like theatrical scenery. A man seated at work on his notes, recording his thoughts onto tape. All this is necessary. He arrives. He moves in with his things. He's here for a purpose. He summons characters, the poetess, the hustler, the politician. He asks the poetess to take off her clothes and read her poems out loud for him. He considers her from various distances while doing other things, smoking cigarettes, noting down words.
Very nice.
Thank you.
That meditative quality. And it's it also has to do with, I think, the poet not investing the poem with a whole lot of meaning. It's as if the meaning arises out of the poem on its own. It's very much impression rather than expression.
Yeah.
Which I find very striking.
Thank you.
It's something that sets your work very much apart from the sort of more classical modernist tradition of the generation that preceded you in Northern Europe. and of course many of your contemporaries as well. These were poets who sought to sort of confront a reality which they considered to be meaningless, and which they in some way or another sought to transform by way of their poetry. You're not in that business at all.
No, metaphoric business.
No, exactly. I mean, the idea of metaphor was very important to them, and is very important to that kind of poetry, but you don't deal in metaphor whatsoever.
I don't. Absolutely not. No.
Another aspect is the fact that the world is sort of perceived in poems like this as a very sort of two-dimensional, very sort of flat structure, which is populated by all sorts of objects and things which seem to have equal importance.
Yes, that's very important. I'm also, that's the equal importance. That's an important thing for me. That's also goes in my films. I like to put things, objects, and persons, and rooms, architecture on the same level, as having the same value, like a game of cards. You know, every card has a value. I like to do that. I like to clearly do that. And in the poems, it's a tendency also clear that I'm conscious of. That nothing is more important than another, and the next word is just as important as the previous one. That's important to dismantle a certain hierarchy in meanings and words in sentences. I like to do that. I like to work with that a lot.
The sense of everything having equal importance as well. I think of the collection of poems you put out in 1967, I think, in Denmark, which was called Sports Poems, which went very much against the grain of this sort of very sort of muscular, as I think you've called it at one time, a muscular modernist tradition with lots of flowery language and lots of metaphor and everything. It went against the grain of that, both linguistically in terms of the language you used.
I stripped it down.
Stripped it down completely, no metaphor. Yeah. But also in terms of the subject matter. These were poems about sport, especially about cycling, and this was something that no proper poet ought to deal with at that time.
It was a polemic. Yeah. There was a statement in it. You know, I was very much. I had published two collections of poetry that was much more much more modernist, much more compressed, etc. But at that moment in history. Art history. I was very much involved in experimental artists, painters, happenings, etc. And there was a general tendency to discover maybe trivial culture. And for me that was a simple choice, because I really had from my childhood a strong fascination for the cycle sport. I was had very early experiences with that because of certain family traditions, and it came back to me as a material that year, and that's why I knew that this would be very provocative to write poems about sports, because as you said, it didn't exist in the vocabulary of cultural life in Denmark, of intellectuals, poets, etc. No, they would never. They thought it was a low kind of culture, sport. It was definitely much more underrated than today. And I flatter myself by saying I have been part of a movement that gave it some shadows, some new understanding, a new reading of the mythological. Part of the sport, for instance, and also the studying of detail. I wanted also to mention before that a real inspiration for me has been Ernest Hemingway. His way of writing, his way of looking at things, describing precisely. I think his best book is Death in the Afternoon, which is a non-fictive work about bullfighting. I think the way he's describing that, the way that he it's a lesson in observation and stripping down language. I love that book, and it has been very important inspiration for some of my writing.
To go back to the idea of the subject matter of sports poems, I should perhaps mention at this point that Jørgen Leth is a household name in Denmark because of his, not so much because of his films or his poetry, but because of his cycling commentaries for Danish television in the Tour de France.
That's true.
Legendary commentaries. Everybody knows Jørgen Leth in Denmark on account of his cycling commentaries. And in fact, sport has resurfaced in your poetry recently in your new collection, where you've actually got a couple of poems which deal with tennis.
I have a poem Roger Federer. About Roger Federer.
I do, and
of course this is conscious. At that moment in the new book, I had already finished the most painful parts. You know, the most confessional stuff and the post. Earthquake things, and I just wanted to finish the book. And at that point, I was following the U.S. Open in tennis. I see all tennis on television. I use nights and hours, you know, to follow the big tennis matches. And I really consciously at that time I was full of myself because I think the book went very well, the writing went very well, and then I wanted to add something, and I consciously thought I wanted to. Do hvad hedder æresrunde?
A lap of honor.
A lap of honor back to the sports poems with writing this poem about Roger Federer
and another
tennis poem. I liked it very much. I liked it as an idea. I liked it as a play.
Yeah. The idea of idolatry of having sports idols, is this something that you subscribe to?
I certainly subscribe to that. Yeah. I have my heroes in sports, and I cannot tire of. Finding language to describe them. I mean, Fausto Coppi, for instance, he's a great hero for me, and I can still find new sides of him. I can still refresh my language about him. I would stop the moment where I couldn't refresh my language about such great figures, such heroic and sometimes tragic figures as some of the great sports people, athletes.
Perhaps it would be a good idea to hear the poem of about Fausto Coppi and the other one about Georges
Saint-Flabin.
Saint-Flabin. Page 15.
Page 23. Yeah.
Fausto Coppi. Perhaps you could tell us who Fausto Coppi was actually. I don't know how big cycling is in Canada. I don't think it's very big at all.
No, it's not too big, but still you should know Fausto Coppi, for God's sake. He was a great writer, Italian writer, who died very early of malaria. And he was the greatest winner of Tour de France and Giro d'Italia, the big big stage races in Europe. He was a fantastic figure, simply because he was thin. He has long, thin legs. He had a very developed case.
Pigeon chest.
Yes, he did. Yeah, pigeon chest, exactly. And he was a tragic figure to look at. He was like a lonely rider. And he what totally took me. And other people, he's a great hero of cycling in general. But he always wanted to go alone, early. So he did the impossible things always. He started his solo rides early, and he could gain as much as 10 minutes, sometimes 15 minutes, in a solo échappé, as we call it in the sport. And he was a man who just turned his back to everything, to the social things of cycling, and he didn't care if he couldn't win. He just wanted to do it his way, whatever. And I wrote several poems about him, and one of them is this very simple one here, short and simple.
And we're back in the 1930s and 40s with Coppi, aren't we?
Yes, I saw him with my own eyes in 57. I was on hitchhike to Italy. And I knew that I wanted to see a certain track, velodrome, in Milano. It was a famous velodrome, exactly because Fausto Coppi had beaten the most famous record in cycling, the one-hour record there, a few years before. I wanted to see it. It's like a temple for me. It's like going to, I don't know, to go to Cambodia and see the Angkor Wat, etc. It's like seeing a temple. I wanted to see this track, a famous wooden track, and it was beautiful. And the most fantastic was that Fausto Coppi was riding on it after a motorbike, training alone, soul always alone. That's so iconographic with him. He's always alone. He's always doing his things alone. And I was totally blown away by seeing my hero, a 57 young man, being there. And then I waited for him after to come out, together with the crowd of his fans, Italian fans, tifosi, and I saw him sit down in his little Fiat, the smallest Fiat, you know, yeah. And and people opened the ring of fans for me because I was a foreigner and I had a Rolleiflex Flex and I wanted to make a photograph of him, so they opened for me, and he looked up. And he gave me one of his very, very rare smiles. He never smiled, but he smiled thinly to me. And that's, yeah, that's... and then the continuation of that story is I go back to the Vespa motorbike with whom I had a lift, and he went away with my... He was not there anymore. He left with my belongings. So I was left with nothing. I had to turn back to Denmark from that moment. But I thought, after a short while, I thought, well, it's worth the price. I saw Fausto Coppi.
Do you still have the photograph of him?
Yes, I do have it.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear about it.
But
let's hear the poem about him.
Yeah.
And I'll just add at this point that my seven-year-old son, he knows all about Fausto Coppi a bit from listening to Jørgen Leth on the television.
And Fausto Coppi died in the 60s after he went to Africa to ride a race in Africa. He shouldn't have done that, but he got malaria and he died suddenly and very fast. So, Fausto Coppi. Fausto Coppi was a fantastic human, most at ease entirely alone. When he attacked in the mountains, no one could follow him. He was a fantastic human. Departed early, Fausto Coppi, Fausto Coppi. That's all. And what about the other one?
That was Georges.
Yeah, what page
23.
Georges Saint-Flaubin. He wasn't a real sprinter, but he was impossible to beat the day he could lead the sprint home in his own way. He was a big, heavy man, but he couldn't be passed the day he found the height to muscle in and could steamroller home in his huge gear. He wasn't a sprinter, but he brought the world to tears the day he repelled Sjerns in Sjerns' desperate bid to become world champion for the seventh time. Yeah, stories. Stories.
The recollections, the memories. Yeah. But Sports Poems was a collection. It wasn't just about idolatry, about sporting idols. It was also very much about childhood. And there's another poem there. Perhaps we could read now. Always more exciting in the mind.
Inside the head.
On page 16.
Yeah.
Altid mere spændende i hovedet.
Yeah. Always more exciting in the mind. Always. It was always more exciting in the mind, because there I could decide myself who should be matched and how it should happen. As a rule, I went into the back garden, stood there for hours and concocted brilliant sprints in my mind. I could make a single heat with Arie van Vliet and Josef Schierens, last a whole day or more. Sometimes I had to break off amid a fight for positions, or perhaps in the middle of a finish, before I had decided whether the Flying Dutchman that day would force home his long sprint from the front without being cheated on the line by the little man with his famous kick. Because someone came and said that now it was time to stop being odd for today. If anyone was odd, it was Josef Schierens from Belgium. His helmet was an outdated round model. He was from another age.
What's the story behind that, Jan?
The story behind that is that when I was a very small boy, from the mid 40s and up to the first 50s, I went to the cycle track in Aarhus and saw these fantastic sprinters. And because my uncle was head of the track, he invited me to come inside, and I met all these fantastic people. And I never forget it. It stays in my head, it stays in my memory. They were glorious people, golden people even. And they had their peculiarities, like Sjerns, who had this strange old-fashioned helmets, and others who there was a famous English sprinter who was a world champion who smoked his pipe sitting waiting for the next hit. That wouldn't happen today.
Was that Reginald Harris?
Reginald Harris, stories.
Yeah. Another aspect of that poem, which is actually quite striking, it's quite an unusual poem in your work, because there's a very clear narrative running through it.
Yeah.
Which is something that generally tends to be absent from your work.
Yes. Yeah, very few times I use narrative. I'm more interested in breaking narratives up, and putting and insisting on notes. Notes is the most important form for me. I'm always, of course, traveling with my notebooks, and that comes, of course, from a very simple thing that early on you discover that if you don't write what you think or what you find, you forget it. So you have to remember it. So I write it down in my notebook always. But then next comes the knowledge that or the thought that notes in themselves constitute a new form. So I have wanted to make several of my films like a collection of notes, and let the story be a collection of notes. That means fragments just put together in a casual order. Often let chance decide which comes next. I like that very much, and this is why this is my way of storytelling. That's to break it up in stories that are independent and which are very condensed and very clear, but which do not lead to another conclusion. So that's a thing I use a lot. Notes are very important, and I call some of my films notebooks, like my film about China. I'm traveling in a train in China. It's called Notebook from China. And my film about love from 89, I call it Notes on Love. It was originally thought as, I wanted to call it originally Catalogue of Love. But I typically stopped short of that because it was too definitive for me. I don't want to do definitive things. I want to let things be open. And very often I prefer films that don't have an ending or conclusion, but are open. So this is a typical choice of that sort. Notes on Love instead of Catalogue of Love. Catalogue of Love would have closed it, I think. But Notes on Love leaves it open and is less demanding, less preposterous in a way.
It's a very sort of a loose organization of things in your poems in many ways, as well as in the films.
Yes.
There's things come together, there's a dynamic going on, and then things disperse for a while. I'm thinking now of, you mentioned at some point, I've read or heard you speak about the Beach Boys as being...
Yes, exactly. I wanted to tell that story.
Your approach to language in this respect.
Yeah,
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I have many art inspirations, you know, like I mentioned Magritte, Godard, Andy Warhol, etc. But I also have some from the world of music, of course. I like Jobim, Antonio Carlos Jobim, very much. But the Beach Boys is the group in question here, because that has a lot to do with this looseness. Yes. You know, what I like with Beach Boys, and it never left me, that fascination, I must say. I still appreciate exactly that quality with their music. It is that it seems sometimes very loose, like just murmuring, talking, then suddenly some form comes out of it, and suddenly it becomes very, very clear, harmonic. And I like this like flowing energy that's in the Beach Boys music. It's like it's flowing, it's floating. And this is a thing I really liked and appreciated as an inspiration for the way I was writing poetry.
The collection here contains actually three poems, I think, which are very illustrative of the technique of using notes in poetry. There might be very extreme examples, actually, but perhaps you could read one of them. I was thinking of a poem called Losing Itself in a Quest for Signs, which is on page 65, I think. It's quite a long poem, but it's illustrates very clearly what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
It's very, very striking in its form.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's like a synopsis for a film.
Yeah.
Losing itself in a quest for signs. Losing itself in a quest for signs. Camera may leave a scene before discharging its meaning, before reaching its climax, or become preoccupied, dwelling on something, inconsequential. How does the food taste in this place? The coffee, the emptiness. Equipment, typewriter, radio, ballpen, paper. All this is me. All this is tangible. True sadness, the view from this window. The world is wide open, the possibilities endless, completely open. I relish the melancholy. I see my hand and my foot. Time is tangible and may be measured on a clock. Banalities close up, body look down at its feet or knees. Tilt down a few times, repetition, the writing hand. Hand writing a fateful sentence. His pocket is full of notes, scraps of paper, calling cards, tickets. Now and then he takes them out, reads them. Linger somewhere, camera describing the place, a few square meters, a door, a section of floor, backwards and forwards, depicting exhaustively. Hotel room. Camera remains after he's left the room, explores on its own or simply remains. Camera, a life of its own breathing, its own taste, its own idiosyncratic way of selecting and discarding. A day's shoot can revolve around a detail, like his right hand, a cup of coffee, the women's backsides, the trees. Camera, slowly approaching nothing, destroying the image, becoming nothing. Feet, coffee, whatever. Woman, knees, neck, throat, face, feet, hands. Mythology, a tube of sunscreen, coffee, sitting down on a chair, spreading butter on bread, drinking a glass of water. Obsession, details, the daily mess that prevents us from seeing clear signs, a constant quest for signs, signals. Mythology, money across the table, money changing hands. The upended postcard, fishing boats putting out early in the morning, sunsets. Camera, striving to categorize and comprehend, for instance, money. Dreamy, suggestive, instinctive. Repetition, return to something yet to be properly understood. Try to establish a system, autocollated, simply indistinct signs. Can a single action be split into seconds? Camera, two angles on the same object, slightly offset in the respect of each other. The cinema films death at work. The person you're filming is in the process of getting older. Therefore, you're filming a minute of death at work. Man and Woman Asleep in Hotel Room, Sculpture, Series, Serial Ideas, Something the Film Wants to Relate, Examine, Piece Together, This Human Being and Its Life. By means of a tracking shot, measure the distance from first word to last word in a sentence. Blurred scenes in the dark, the demonic depths of a tropical night. To transform this life into sheets of written paper or meters of exposed film. A collection of material, searching for a language in this material, cohesion, clear, unambiguous settings, a tropical beach, scrub, White House, swimming pool, Hockney, market, persons, objects positioned in the dark, camera with bright lamp approaching, retreating. Scene. He sits at a table counting dirty notes. He rises. I have an acute feeling of decay, disintegration. I'm going to get a newspaper. Scene. I think about my son a lot. I love him. I love him. Scene. The face. A house. At varying distances. In varying lights. Scene. I fit it with my hair. I have nothing to say.
Very clear. The technique of notes there. It sounds like, I mean, what's the process there? I mean, you write something in your notebooks, and this sounds as almost as if it's lifted directly from the notebook without any form of intervention at all.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I like the idea of ready-made, you know, for Marcel Duchamp. That has played a big role for my work in film and also in poetry. I sometimes lifted quotes from James Bond books, for instance. Yeah. Do you know that the most signature dialogue in some of my films, in The Perfect Human, up till now, is also today I experience something that I hope to discover, I hope to understand in a few days, etc., etc. In my and the description in my the white point in the where the heart is. That's lifted from the first page of what's the name of the author?
Ian Fleming.
Yeah, Ian Fleming's book, Tordenkiel, what is that på engelsk?
Absolutely no idea. Thunderball, no? Yeah.
Thunderball.
Yeah.
Who said that? Yes. Yeah. Do you actually recognize this sentence? Okay, yeah, I am too. So I lifted this piece of text and modified it a little bit, and that's the most prominent signature dialogue in Perfect Human, Good and Evil, Notes on Love, and again in The Five Obstructions. So that's a ready-made for me. That's something that I take out of literature and I duly pay credit to it in the notes, but I like the idea of ready-made, of taking something that's already there. And I also do it in this case, you're right in that, I'm lifting something from my own notebook. That's to take the consequence of the idea of the inspiration from notes. I think I felt it could be interesting to simply take the notes, and I liked how it was. I liked the chance kind of sentences getting together there. There was an element of chance in it. I believe very much in chance. Chance is an element I work with consciously in my films and in my poetry. For instance, I rarely alter a poem when it's written. I don't get back to it and begin to alter it at all. I like it to be there, and like the Chinese ink artist, you know, they can't change it. It's there, and you can't go back and change it. I have the same feeling with poetry. It's like there's an element of you might think that because of the subject matter in my poetry that I'm that I may not be interested in magic, but I believe poetry is magic. I believe that there's a mystery in the process. I think there's an element of alchemy in writing poetry. And I'm writing that directly in the new collection of poetry. I think, you know, the more condensed it is, you know, the more experimental, the more laboratory the language is exposed to, the more chance there is that something magic comes out. I've experienced that.
So it's kind of like a divine inspiration that appears from somewhere. It's not like you sort of having an idea and then working on the idea.
No.
How long does it take you to write a poem?
If I'm in shape to write it, it takes not much time. You know, if I write a poem, it takes a few minutes.
Yeah.
And then it's there. And then I like to see it again and again, but I rarely change it. But you know, the process of reaching the point of being able to write, that's a painful process. As always in art, it takes a long time to reach the point of getting liberated enough, getting confident enough to go in that direction. Then suddenly it is there. Then it takes very little time. It's a process that, this collection that I produced most of it in Haiti in February, March, a lot of poems came in that period, but I couldn't finish it. And then I took the half of the book as it was with me when I traveled to Denmark in April, and I thought I'll find time. But that was very hard to get re-ignited in the writing. That was very hard. It cannot be underestimated, the pain it takes to get back, to get yourself in a position to write poetry. That's what takes time. And that must take a lot of sometimes desperation. There are often questions about a block of writing, what they call a writer's block. Oh, yes, absolutely. But when I am started, I can write a poem I would say that would be in half an hour, and look at it and then see what it's there.
So is that something you decide to do? I mean, you spoke about renting holiday homes off season and going somewhere. You decide to go somewhere to produce poetry?
Yes. I think I'm experienced enough to know when there's something, because that's also a question, do you have something? Do you have a solid substance inspiration? Do you have a reason to write? And that's difficult. That's a difficult point. I had that reason in February, and I don't go to the expense of the inconvenience to go to a summer house in Denmark. That's many years ago, you know. That was when I was married in Denmark. 20 years I lived in Haiti. That's different. But then I do not go to that. What did you call it?
Holiday home.
I don't go such a place if I don't. Yeah. If I'm not convinced, I can write again.
Yeah.
So I feel there's something that's getting together in my head somewhere, or in my body, I don't know, and so I feel I have something to write, and it happens. That happens sometimes, you know. Now, right now, I'm writing my third volume of memoirs, but it's very difficult, very sensitive. If I make a break, like going to Montreal, you know, in the middle of that process, that's very complicated.
You haven't been writing poetry here.
Yeah, that's you haven't had the time, not good. I have to get back. Yeah. No.
But it's not like, I mean, so in terms of subject matter, it's not like you say to yourself, "Well, I feel the need to go somewhere and write a poem about what's going on in Afghanistan or whatever."
No.
I mean, the subjects just appear to you because you sit down and you want to write poetry.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Except when I'm a journalist. I'm writing essays about Haiti, about the situation in Haiti, etc. But that's also a very subjective way of describing that. But that's different. You have a subject which is clearly there, which is visible and which is happening and very dramatically. So I have to describe that.
You mentioned Haiti, which makes me think of chaos in some way or another, and and the idea of ordering chaos is also a very strong theme in your poetry, which sort of manifests itself in this sort of way of itemizing and cataloging reality, the things around you. Many of your poems, or a number of your poems, start off by you sort of simply describing what's around you, what's on the desk in front of you, what's on the wall next to you, or whatever.
It's a strong drive for me.
Yeah.
To create order in chaos, really. I think chaos is a threat all the time in my life, and probably for other people's lives also, but I need to deal with it. I think poetry is a way to create order. So very manifestly in my poetry, I try to create order. For instance, on the table, I'm writing about what I see on the table. So it's a catalog I'm making of what I can see. But my credo is to only write about what I can see. And then if things come in the process of writing about what I see, then it comes in. For instance, something happening on television or whatever, or something happening in the newspaper, it could come in. But only in the process if I'm already there, if I'm already in a situation where I'm describing what I can see. It's very important for me. It's a statement also, of course, it's also an anti-ideological way of writing.
Perhaps you'd like to read a couple more poems, which I think illustrate this idea of trying to order the chaos around you. I was thinking of a poem called "There's a Mess Outside." Which is on page something or other.
40.
On 40. Yeah. Okay. Right.
I'll read that.
Yeah, let's do that.
There's a mess outside. There's a mess outside. Some houses that don't become each other. A sky not worth talking about. Birds flying back and forth. A meaningless section of a mountain. A mishmash of human voices with nothing to say to each other. Sounds of all sorts of activity. I don't care to know about, with nothing to say to each other, sounds of all sorts of activity I don't care to know about. Only here is the order, music that can be changed, a lamp casting an even light on these words I'm arranging in lines.
There's a very clear sense of disorder outside and creating order within.
Absolutely. It's another piece of, I don't know, therapy. But it's first of all, it's interesting that you can. It's also an example of what I call an alchemy. You work with things that are meaningless and don't get together, and then you put them in a poem, and suddenly something happens. Yeah. I call it getting something out of nothing. That's what I call it.
There's another example which I'd like you to read, which is a poem called Water, which is actually part of a sort of a little sort of suite of poems in one of your collections, a collection called What the Picture Shows, where you look at sort of everyday things and try to basically to get a handle on them, to investigate them. And find out what they are, what they're all about. Not in any scientific way. When you describe water, it's not because you're interested in the chemistry of water, but in an artistic way. You're interested in the relevance of it.
Yeah.
Is it drinkable? Is it not drinkable? Yeah. Or whatever.
It's from a series of poems that I wrote in my house in Jacmel, the house that was destroyed in the earthquake. I wrote these poems a few years ago. And it's a lot of observations from daily life, what I could see there, things that I came to my mind that was from everyday, as you call it so good in the title, trivial everyday things. Trivial everyday things. Water is a trivial everyday thing, right? I will read it. Water.
I'll have some too.
Water. It comes out of the tap. It is pumped up into the house in order to come down again. Water is sometimes not there when you want it, Water comes in through pipes which perhaps are not spacious enough, or are broken, or are not receiving water to lead. Water is filtered in the pool by the pump. When the pump works, or water is stagnant in the pool, undisturbed for many days, and acquires a different color and a dusty surface, broken by petals and insects. And water stands in plastic jugs in a refrigerator and is cool, except when the refrigerator has fallen asleep and does not hum. Water is water, which comes out of the tap and which can be put in the mouth, but has to be spat out again. And water is water, which is contained in a bottle and can be used to put in the mouth and swallow. It's a very Haitian situation.
Yeah.
It's not water in Montreal, you know, no. In Denmark, no.
Well, now we know all about water in Haiti.
Yeah.
So you're getting a handle.
I like
on
dramas in everyday things. I like to observe drama in everyday things and problems in everyday things. That's that was describing. That was giving voice, I think, in poetry.
Right. I think for a poet who likes to deal with the subject of ordering chaos, Haiti is a good place to practice, I imagine.
Very good place.
It's a very chaotic place. I mean, for me, I mean, I saw the film Haiti Untitled again the other night. And as a sort of North European, non-tropical sort of person, Haiti appears to me to be
chaotic.
Dante-esque inferno of voodoo and hard liquor and chaos and fire and brimstone and a nightmarish place in many respects.
Well, that's a very good description, Giver. It seems to be.
Seems
to be. And what I'm trying in this film and in some of this poetry is to decipher it, to decipher this chaos, the Dantesque chaos. You can easily use the word Dantesque. Like when you come to Haiti and you travel through the suburbs of Port-au-Prince, it is Dantesque. The scenes that you see are Dantesque. I often thought, well, this is the ultimate film you could do. Stop every 10 meters and film just what you see. It's just too dangerous. But it fascinates me every time I come. And really, contrary to your reading of it, I fell in love with this chaos, indescribable chaos. I'm trying to describe it, and there is some system in it, and that's what I'm trying to decipher out of it. You know, I'm trying to really describe the chaos and find the patterns that validify the chaotic things that you see. And you know, I wanted in the film that you are mentioning, I wanted to give an answer to the question I'm often asked: why do you live in that country? I'm asked that question often, and I at some point, this is back in the 1990s, I had lived there 3 years at that time, and I needed to answer that question also for myself, because I sometimes ask myself, why am I living there? It's too chaotic. It's too frustrating. Every day is full of problems. Full of problems, unimaginable problems. Everything goes bad in Haiti, always, and it will go bad. That's my analysis of the political situation. It's bad now, it will be worse tomorrow. That's my analysis. And still I have hope for Haiti, and I love the Haitians, and I love to... I'm learning so much about life by living in Haiti. I learn so much from these wonderful people, really, who have all these problems, but also have a willpower and a humor that surmounts all the nonsense they are facing from day to day, impossible conditions. So I'm really in love with Haiti. And in that film, I wanted to put all the elements that fascinate me in Haiti. I mean, I didn't want to make an easy answer to that question, because the question is difficult. It deserves a complicated answer also, or at least an answer that contains all the paradoxes that I like in Haiti. I like the political drama, the political intrigue. I'm a storyteller. I'm inspired by the political intrigue. It's too crazy. It's too crazy, frankly, and it's going on all the time. It's like it's more crazy than Tintin. You know, it's more crazy, and I like it. I follow it, and I really think the figures in this drama are fantastic, super figures, villains and heroes, among most villains. And I'm very interested in the villains. I have described villains in several films, and I think it's much more interesting to talk to villains than to talk to the good guys. Absolutely, the villains are much more interesting. Then it has to contain the political intrigue. It has to contain voodoo, that I'm a big admirer of. I like voodoo. It has been given me many good experiences in Haiti. Not because I'm a Buddhist. I have no religious gene. I'm not. I cannot be convinced to be initiated or anything. But I like voodoo. I like to participate as not participate directly, but be a spectator to voodoo ceremonies. And I go often because of the humor, because of the human feeling in it. It's a very strong experience for me. I also wanted to have the sweetness of everyday life on the countryside in Haiti, which has always been charming me. I really felt very warm around the heart because of what I saw on the countryside in Haiti. And then the fourth element had to be the sensuality in Haiti. I mean, also the women in Haiti that I like very much. And I think that Graham Greene was right in his book, Comedians, when he said the most beautiful women in the world are the Haitian women. I agree with him on that. So that was the fourth element. I needed to have all these four elements in my film. And how did we come here? So that's...
Well, we were talking about Haiti and chaos.
I'm getting carried away. When I talk about Haiti, I'm getting carried away.
I actually sat when I was coming over here on the plane. I had this film with me, Thomas Gislason's. It's a documentary film on Jørn's life in Haiti, or at least filmed in Haiti. A film from 1994. In Danish, it's called Fra Hjertet til Hånden, which has the English title Heart and Soul. I'm sure you'll be able to find it on Amazon. And it's a fascinating document. When's that from? 1994, something like that.
94, yeah.
Yeah. An excellent film, Heart and Soul. Good. You mentioned the Haitian women.
Yeah.
Are we going to talk about them now?
Yeah, let's
do so.
Yes.
Let's do so.
Yeah. Back.
Well, you said yourself that one of the attractions of Haiti for you is the women, and I think you've cited Graham Greene as well, who said I believe that the Haitian women were the most beautiful in the world.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's right.
He is right. No right. Offense.
We mentioned the film Erotic Man, which obviously a lot of which takes place in Haiti as well, and in which there are several of your poems which feature very strongly, and several erotic poems, some of which are in this collection as well.
Yeah,
I thought perhaps we could have a look at a couple of those. Firstly, the poem called Holding Your Hands, which is on page 58, and I know you like that poem very much. I hope you like the translation equally.
I do, I have read it, you know, I like it very much. It's readable.
It's readable, yeah, very important.
And it features, of course, in the film. I have several actresses in the film read this poem. It's written by a man, but I like to have the women read it. And they like to read it. The two in Portuguese, three Brazilian actresses, and the Senegalese actress, and myself also. Yeah, so I'll read it now. Holding your hands. Holding your hands tight above your head with my left hand. Taking your left knee with my right hand and bending it outward, thereby spreading your legs, looking at you. Looking at you. fastening my gaze on your eyes, then fixing in my mind, in one seamless passage, this whole order as it presents itself, your neck, your shoulders, your breasts, your belly, your thighs, noting the entire arrangement and making love to you objectively and in detail. I see beads of sweat assume form and spill down slowly, then quickly over your skin. Breathe in your scent. Fasten my gaze on you. I can see you so clearly, so clearly. Take a grip on your flesh, framing your hips in a tight shot. And this could happen. This could happen here at the Hotel Amazonas in Manaus, where iron balconies are rusting and Italian tenors once sang of immortal lovemaking in the dense equatorial night. And this could happen again at the Grand Hotel in Cruzeiro, where I will rise from the bed and go to the window and look out on the São Francisco River, in which the full moon is mirrored. And here I will pull the curtain aside and let the moon illuminate your naked body for an exactly apportioned number of seconds, thereby exposing a single image like the anthropologist of old portrayed unknown jungle tribes. I will make love to you objectively and in detail, and in the early morning produce an impression made fleeting by the heat of my recollection of this mise-en-scene one night at the river.
Yeah, very, very sensual poem. The film Erotic Man was very well received here in Montreal and in most other places as well. But you've told me that in Amsterdam, of all places, there were a lot of people, or at least some people, who weren't very happy about it because of the erotic content, which they seemed to think was in some way disturbing or offensive.
Yeah, but why? Because there's no sex scenes, there are no porno scenes in the film. There's only a description of a lot of beautiful women, and first of all, it's a reflection of memoirs about love, about the erotic attraction, about eroticism. It's an essay on that. It's a poetic essay about that. But yes, it's true that in Amsterdam, I think the hardcore feminists disliked the fact that an old white man likes young women from an underdeveloped part of the world. And that's a constant coming back. It's a political correctness that I don't agree with. You know, when you live in such a country, you enter in contracts or in deals, social deals. You enter in a complete social play, and I'm very conscious of that. And I behave well. I have long relationships, and many years, and it's not what they depicted as. No, it's not. It's for instance, the hardcore feminists, I think one of the motives for their anger is, if I may say that, is jealousy. Quite simply, it's jealousy. They can't stand that an older man likes to have affairs with women from another part of the world, and especially they don't like that an older man likes to have affairs with younger women than themselves, for instance.
They see it as exploitative.
Yeah, they think so. And they put all kinds of stamps on it, like colonialist. But, you know, I know how to live in this country. And I have fantastic relations with the people I deal with in Haiti. That's why I couldn't stay if I didn't have that. I like the Haitians. I like Haitians of the lower part of the population. I mean, the lower 90% of the population, you know.
you were in another respect.
I don't like the mulattoes very much because they are exercising an enormous suppression of the rest of the country. That's one of the dramas of Haiti.
It's the bourgeoisie.
The bourgeoisie is a terrible bourgeoisie. It's a very bad bourgeoisie. they are totally amoral in social affairs.
You were put through the media mill in Denmark when the first volume of your memoirs came out about 4 or 5 years ago, The Imperfect Human, because of a passage in that book.
You have to remind us of this.
I have to remind you of it. But the reason I want to remind you of it is because you responded so well to it. You responded poetically. You responded in interviews after a while as well, but you responded in poetry as well.
Yeah.
And there's if you could just read the poem, which was your first response in that respect, Time Has Stopped, on page 100.
Yeah.
And then we'll keep an eye on the time, I think.
So, yeah, this is a really polemic, a rare polemic poem from my side. Yeah. A rare one. Probably needed to write it, I think. Time has stopped. He's been keeping a young girl as a sex slave in his house. He whips her. He demands she be at his complete disposal and do what he says. He's a very cruel man. He had her given to him by her sailor's mother and hung her up immediately in the doorframe with chains. She's a lovely slave. He relishes her being his. He owns her. He turns her over so she's lying on her back, and he fucks her head on. Then he stops and turns her quickly around so she's lying on the stomach and pulls her onto her knees so he can take her from behind. Criminally from behind. It's his right, from behind. He bought her at the market price and sends now a leisure's sort to the old slave ships and to the French colonial masters who brutally divided families who came from Africa and took for themselves the girls who caught their fancy. That's when it all began. This man here, he has a beautiful slave girl. She's allowed to go to school. He takes care of her education and of bringing her up. And when she comes to him on the top floor, she learns something more about life. She can learn a lot about love, and it needs to be like nothing. She comes to him when he calls and discovers his cock is hard. Then the work begins. She must be ready and take off her clothes. Her cunt is wet. Cunts are always wet in the tropics. He wants to use her. She belongs to him. He will take her when it suits him. It is his right. It is his right. That sentence is very important. And when it suits him, in other words, she is his. He owns her. He can do what he wants with her. She is his slave. This is what they say. This is what they shout. This is what they scream. She is his slave. Time has stopped in Haiti. The white man has slaves. The white man owns his staff, can use their daughters as he pleases. This is what it's about. This is where the story lies. This is where Haiti's story has stopped. He's the colonial master, years after colonies were abolished and the black slaves won their freedom, dizzying to think it should still be possible to own another person. The cook smiles, the butler smiles. It is the master's hour now. God watches from above. Music now. Shocking poem.
It's a poem that's laced with sarcasm and irony and anger. Did you enjoy writing that poem?
Yes, because I needed to.
Response.
I needed to respond to the nonsense that was written, so I needed to use their exact words actually, and that's what I do in this poem. So in a way, that's also a way to use used language, as in the ready-made poems to mention them. But it's a way to get back to them. With their own words. I was shocked, in fact, during this debate, because I was shocked of the ugly use of language in the debate, in the attacks against me. They were very ugly. In my book, there's if I may say so, there's no such things as vulgarity and ugliness at all. So I had to react against that. I had to use their own words. I had to smear them with their own words. That was the intention with this poem. So it was I'm sitting writing this collection of poetry, and I needed to come out with that.
And you weren't finished with it then either, because your new collection actually contains, three or four poems along the same lines, yeah. Are you done with it now?
I'm done with it, yeah. And also, in Denmark, the time has totally changed. The debate some newspaper, important newspaper wrote, I've only become stronger during this debate. I have a big audience today. And there's a shame connected with this new Puritan wave that came up there. So it was also a time of clearness about that. That Denmark was less, less free than we thought.
Jørn, we're going to round things off now. I've been sort of following you for the last week or so here in Montreal, and have watched you, listened to you battling heroically against the demons of the French language. You've done it very, very well indeed. But I thought, as a way of ending here tonight, I thought I'd give Jørn the present of him being allowed to speak Danish for once.
So acceptable.
Perhaps you'd like to read one final poem in Danish. And I was thinking,
if you choose it.
Okay, I'll choose it. And it's the poem which is called A Short Poem in English. It's the one that's called Lin Brunskaya. The Collected Poems, page 225.
Yeah.
In English afterwards.
Okay. You ready?
I'm ready.
As soon as it passes there. Yeah. Lige nu ønsker jeg at kunne skrive et kort digt. Jeg har papir i maskinen. Jeg snuser til min arm. Jeg snuser til min arm igen. Jeg tænker på, hvad jeg vil. Jeg er færdig. Jeg har skrevet et kort digt.
A short poem. Right now, I want to be able to write a short poem. I've paper in the typewriter. I sniff my arm. I sniff my arm again. I think about what I want. I've finished. I've written a short poem. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you to Jørn. I hope you've had a good experience.